From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. 3 years ago today, WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange walked into Ecuador's embassy in London to seek political asylum. The Australian whistleblower has been there ever since. If he leaves the building, Assange would likely be arrested and ultimately extradited to the U.S. to face charges over the release by WikiLeaks of military documents, which deeply embarrassed Washington. RT's Polly Boyko filed this report from London.
He's been stuck inside these four walls for 3 years now. But in that time, Julian Assange, who's going to turn 44 in 2 weeks' time, has managed to rack up a few milestones. He's made a bid for the Australian Senate, addressed the United Nations on human rights, been the subject of a Hollywood blockbuster, and even appeared in an episode of The Simpsons. Celebrities including Yoko Ono, Lady Gaga, and John Cusack have popped in to see him too.
Back in March, there was a small victory for the whistleblower when Sweden's prosecutor agreed to come and interview him here in London over allegations of sexual offences made against him in Sweden. But that appointment, which was meant to take place this week, has been cancelled because the Swedish authorities haven't obtained the right paperwork to enter the Ecuadorian embassy. So his fate still hangs in the balance, and his daily life is limited to a room so tiny that he's likened it to living on a space station. He's said to get takeaway food delivered here on a regular basis, pizzas and sushi from nearby restaurants, and a personal trainer comes to help him keep fit. But last year there were reports that he's suffering from health problems as a result of never going outside. In fact, out here, there's little sign that a famous figure lives just feet away. Well, except for the police officers, who are ready to pounce on him if he decides to emerge.
Have you ever seen pictures of this man?
Richard Branson?
No. Almost. He looks
almost
a bit like him.
Like, I don't know. Really.
He's a journalist or someone, so he can't go out because he done something wrong against UK.
It's Julian Assange.
Oh, sure. Okay, got it.
I thought he was in Ecuador.
Let him stay there for the rest of his life.
Everything he's done is pretty epic. A lot of people don't appreciate the effort he's gone to make sure people are aware of what's going on.
Julian Assange is just the latest and most high-profile individual to take refuge in a diplomatic mission. And today's three-year anniversary isn't going to get him in the record books just yet. Afghan President Mohammad Najibullah took shelter in Kabul's UN mission for 4 years, 5 months and 11 days. Then there was a group of Russian Christians known as the Siberian Seven. They spent half a decade holed up in the underground mailroom of Moscow's US embassy before being allowed to emigrate. But the trophy for the longest embassy stint goes to an anti-communist Hungarian cardinal who took refuge in the US mission in Budapest in 1956. Josef Mincenti had been inside for a whopping 15 years.
Last August, at a press conference that I attended inside the embassy, Julian Assange said, rather cryptically, that he was planning on leaving soon, but that he had no plans of handing himself in to the British police. So, once again, the reporters flocked here. But there was no dramatic finale. And considering that just this week the Ecuadorian president has said that Julian Assange could spend his entire lifetime here, some are beginning to think that there might not be one. Reporting from outside London's Ecuadorian embassy, I'm Polly Boyko.
The cancellation by Swedish prosecutors of a meeting with Assange that was set to take place in the Ecuadorian embassy in London prompted Ecuador's foreign minister, Ricardo Patillo, to accuse Stockholm of violating Assange's rights by repeatedly delaying any decision to allow him to testify from the London embassy. Yemeni resistance forces are again taking their fight into Saudi Arabia as they defend their country from a Saudi invasion and air attack that is about to enter its fourth month. Press TV's Kanish Fatima has more.
Saudi fighter jets continue their deadly airstrikes on Yemen. The latest raids have left at least 22 civilians dead in Saada province. The casualties were reported from an assault on Saada's Bani Mu'in and Razeh regions. Saudi aircraft also targeted several other locations in the province, including residential houses. Meanwhile, Saudi aircraft launched airstrikes on Yemen's capital, Sana'a. Earlier, Yemen's TV said warplanes used banned cluster bombs against the Mazraq region in Hadja province. On Thursday, negotiators from Yemen's Ansar Allah movement in Geneva accused Saudi Arabia of using internationally banned weapons and committing genocide in Yemen.
We have victims, women and children, weapons which have been forbidden internationally. Phosphoric bombs have been used, like what happened in the Jabal Nukhub area. This led to the destruction of civilian neighborhoods as a whole.
Head of Ansar Allah delegation Hamza Al-Houthi released a number of photos that he says show Saudi Arabia using phosphorus bombs in its airstrikes against residential areas. He told Press TV that relentless Saudi airstrikes have claimed thousands of lives and devastated the country's infrastructure. Nearly 4,400 Yemenis, many of them women and children, have been killed in the Saudi onslaught that began on March the 26th.
The joint forces targeted several military sites in Saudi Arabia and attacked the Saudi Border Guard headquarters in the region, as well as military positions in the mountainous areas along the border. Yemeni forces also hit various Saudi artillery positions and stormed a military base. Meanwhile, Yemeni army and allied public committees have taken control of areas near Anshah at its Aden province. The area was controlled by al-Qaeda and forces loyal to fugitive ex-president Abdurrahman Mansour Hadi. Dozens of al-Qaeda fighters were killed in the battle. The Saudi military campaign has been coordinated with the al-Qaeda forces.
The so-called Greek problem is not a Greek problem, it's a European problem. The problem is not called Greece, the problem is called Eurozone, and it concerns its structure.
A day after his country was again stymied in the attempt to renegotiate its debt to European financial institutions, Greece's Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras, in Russia at the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum, said Friday that, quote, "The economic center of the planet has shifted. There are new emerging forces that are playing a more important role geopolitically and economically," closed quote, adding that international relations are more and more characterized by multipolarity. Tsipras found both love and money in the former Russian capital with the announcement Friday of the signing of a $2 billion deal on the Turkish stream gas pipeline and a commitment by Russia that it would finance future infrastructure projects in Greece. With discounted gas, the income stream from the pipeline, and increased Russian investment and tourism, a major economic boost will be provided to the country, an alternative to the austerity and debt being offered by the EU.
As all of you are fully aware, we are at the moment at the center of a storm, of a whirlpool. But, you know, we live near the sea, so we're not scared of storms. We're not scared of open seas and of going into new seas. We are ready to go to new seas in order to reach new safe ports.
Greece's prime minister also took aim at U.S. and EU policy towards Russia, saying that the crisis in Ukraine, quote, has opened a new wound in the heart of Europe, a wound of instability, closed quote, and that instead of prosperity and economic cooperation in the region, there were, quote, processes leading to war, militarization, and the implementation of sanctions beginning, and this vicious cycle needs to end as soon as possible, closed quote. Within minutes of his presentation, the European Central Bank agreed to pump more funds into Greek banks that it said were intended to prevent a full-blown financial emergency in Greece. That decision was taken over a hastily convened conference call Friday. Many EU countries have suffered economically from the U.S.-led sanctions against Russia, and Europe is now playing host to the U.S.-led military buildup that many fear could lead to further war on the continent beyond the one already taking place in Ukraine. One such voice from Germany is industrialist Heinz Hermann Thiel, chair of Knorr Bremse, a German brakes maker, and Wasler, a German transport technology manufacturer.
I was, and I'm still are, totally against the sanctions, from the very beginning, by the way, and I'm not the only one in the German economy who have this position. It is high time, and I support the statement of President Putin It's high time to stop these sanctions. And I hope now everybody in Europe has understand that this sanction have hurt Europe substantially. If you look to the figures, for instance, within 2 years, 2014 and 2015, Germany has lost 50% of their exports to Russia. If you look to, yes, I don't consider the local entities which we operate in your country in Russia, where we also are heavily involved. And quite successfully, by the way, with your industry and the transport area. And we have very good experience with our partner in Russia. Coming back to other European countries, look to Italy, for instance. Italy is losing only 10% of their exports in comparison with last year. So it looks quite good for them. So the consequences in the different countries in Europe are totally different. And also the interests are totally different. We have no common interest in that respect. We have common decisions on the political level, but whatever the reasons are and the backgrounds are, this is totally wrong. And we need to understand that also Russia turning to the East is doing something quite normal, you see, because the East has a lot of opportunities to offer to Russia. And don't forget, we Europeans and specifically Germans, even my company, I have a medium-sized company who is globally operating, we have strong connections with Chinese and I'm an extremely good business. And we are very pleased to work together with the Chinese. So why shouldn't Russia do the same? But the tragedy, in a way, maybe that's a little bit over-exaggerated, is the fact that we have boosted that trend by applying the sanctions. We must go away from that. But everybody should have the chance to make his decision where he finds the best partners for his specific business. Whether it's in the West or it's in the East, doesn't matter. We are supporting the global development, and I would like to add a peaceful development, which is not, at this moment, not satisfying at all.
He spoke at a plenary session of the St. Petersburg Forum with a number of others, including Russia's President Putin.
Well, the future of relations between Russia and any partner country depends not just on Russia. It's a two-way street, and we cannot achieve positive results through unilateral actions. But we strive to develop relations with Germany. My colleague just spoke about a large number of German companies that are present on the Russian market. We're talking about 6,200 companies, and they all stayed, they're all still present. About 100-150 reduced their volume somewhat, but they remain present and they remain active. Moreover, I mentioned new enterprises opening up. One was launched today, and German companies, among others, were involved. We have traditional cooperation with them, and we are not planning to disrupt or even limit this cooperation. And this is not something that German businesses are seeking. We have very good, reliable, long-standing relations with them, and we'll do our utmost to preserve and develop them for the sake of Russia, Germany, European continent in general, and global economy alike. We spoke about the current state of the global economy. We are all aware that In general, experts highlighting two big issues, low growth rate, some even speak about stagnation, you know that, and experts think that the situation is likely to remain the same for some 24 months. And the second problem is excessive growth of debt burden that impedes growth. Country-wise, if we're talking about Europe, look at what's happening. Germany is showing very moderate growth, 1% last year. Look at France, 0.7%. Italy, colleague just mentioned, saying that things are all right. For a number of years, they've been having zero growth. In Japan, it's minus 1.4, by the way. That said, it is obvious that we all need additional points of growth, incentives for development. Mr. Tsipras said that the problem of Greece is not just a problem for Greece, but for all of Europe. I even took note of that. But when you owe somebody, you know, it's not just your problem, it's the problem of your lender as well, true.
But
look at what happened. Integration processes offer a lot of benefits, open markets, cheap loans, etc. But there are also downfalls. You cannot regulate national currency because there is no longer a national currency, and you are very tightly linked to currency that is oriented to export economy. You cannot manage your policies in agriculture, tourism, fisheries. There are restrictions, there are limitations. So it has to be very balanced. But we are curious, because we are following very closely what happens in Europe, because it's our major trading partner. Indeed, volume of trade went down, bilateral trade with Europe, significantly so, but Europe still remains our leading trading partner. And Germany is number one out of all European countries, and I hope that problems will go away and we'll continue developing relationship further. We are prepared.
The situation facing Greece and the EU was detailed again Thursday by Greece's finance minister, Yanis Varoufakis, who spoke to the press after Thursday's negotiations between Greece and its creditors broke off.
Ladies and gentlemen, in today's Eurogroup meeting, our side sent a strong signal to our partners and to the institutions by presenting a comprehensive proposal that can, if accepted, in a short space of time, resolve the Greek crisis once and for all. We explained that the two sides, Greece and the institutions, had already come really close to an agreement on very important parts of that agreement. In fiscal terms, our concessions over the last weeks and months have brought us within half a percentage point of GDP of what the institutions are proposing and demanding. This gap is too small to justify a dangerous impasse. The real reason why negotiations were interrupted a few days ago was that the institutions, as their delegates told our delegates, did not have a mandate to negotiate that particular tiny gap and the ways in which it would be filled, and moreover, they did not have a mandate to discuss trade-offs between parametric reforms that the institutions demanded and our proposals for the essential debt swaps that would allow Greece to end the crisis, to return to the markets shortly after the announcement of an agreement. In short, our proposals for not just completing the current program, but for ending the crisis. In our presentation, in the context of the Eurogroup, I mentioned Dr. Olivier Blanchard's article, a recent article. Dr. Blanchard is the IMF's chief economist, let me remind you, with a very pertinent title. The title being, Greece, a credible deal will require difficult decisions by all sides. He's of course right, but the three operative words are by all sides. How much of an adjustment has to be made by Greece, Dr. Blanchard asks? And how much of an adjustment needs to be made by the institutions, by the official creditors? This is a hugely important question. That Greece needs to adjust, there is no doubt whatsoever. The question, however, is not how much adjustment needs to do, to make. It is rather what kind of adjustment that Greece has adjusted over the last 5 years. There is no doubt, is there? The public sector structural deficit has declined by a world record-beating 20%. Wages have fallen by 37%. Pensions were reduced by up to 48%. State employment diminished by almost a third. Consumer spending was curtailed by 33%. Even our current account deficit went down by 16%. So no one can say that Greece has not adjusted to its new circumstances after the great financial crisis of 2008. But what we can also say is that this gigantic adjustment of the last 5 years has produced many problems. You all know that real GDP has fallen by 27%, that unemployment has almost reached 30%, that we are now currently, as I speak, are suffering from a deflation rate of minus 2%, that undeclared labor has gone beyond 33%, that banks are laboring under non-performing loans that exceed 37-38%. Public debt, because of GDP's collapsed, is now at 180% of GDP. Young, very well qualified people who have been educated, whose human capital has been produced by public expenditure in Greece, have left Greece and are offering their services and their skills to other nations. Poverty, hunger, even energy deprivation have registered increases usually associated with a state at war. Investment in productive capacity has evaporated. So the first part of Dr. Blanchard's question, how much of an adjustment has to be made by Greece, needs to be answered. Greece needs a great deal of adjustment, but not that kind of adjustment. We need reforms, not more cutbacks, not more parametric changes or increases in tax rates. We need to adjust, there's no doubt about that, to a new culture of paying taxes. But that is not helped by hiking taxes without reforming the tax system. We need to make the pension system sustainable by eradicating unpaid labor, minimizing early retirements, eliminating pension fund fraud, boosting employment, not by eradicating the solidarity tranche from the lowest of the low of pensions, because that simply creates popular discontent that does not allow the Greek population or enable the Greek population to become owners of the reform agenda. In our proposals to the institutions over the last few weeks, we offered an extensive privatization agenda spanning the period, the 10-year period, the decade beginning this year, the creation of a fully independent tax and customs authority modeled on the IRS in the United States, or the British equivalent, a fiscal council that oversees the state budget, a short-term program for limiting foreclosures and managing non-performing loans, liberalization of several product markets and services, elimination of many nuisance charges, public administration reforms that include proper staff evaluation procedures, reducing non-wage costs, modernizing and unifying public sector payrolls. Now, in addition to the reforms that we offered in the last few weeks to the institutions, the Greek authorities have engaged the OECD, the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, to help Athens, the Athens government, design, implement, and monitor a second series of reforms, independent of those that we have been negotiating with the institutions. Only yesterday, I met with the Secretary General of the OECD, Mr. Angel Gurria, and his team to announce this joint reform agenda, complete with a specific roadmap and a program that focuses on key areas. For instance, we decided to work together towards a major anti-corruption drive and relevant institutions to support it, especially in the area of public procurement, liberalization of the construction sector, including the market and standardization of construction materials, wholesale trade liberalization, the media, the world of the media, electronic and press codes of practice, the establishment of one-stop business centers that eradicate the bureaucratic impediments to doing business in Greece and digitalize the process of securing licensing and also tax file numbers for startups and new companies. pension system reform, where the emphasis will be on a proper long-term actuarial study, the phasing out of early retirements, the reduction in the operating cost of the pension funds, rather than merely cutting pensions. So there is no doubt the Greek government is utterly committed to adjusting further. We desperately need these deep reforms, but I urged my colleagues in the Eurogroup to take seriously under consideration the great difference between, on the one hand, reforms that attack parasitic rent-seeking behavior and inefficiencies, and on the other hand, parametric changes that simply jack up already high tax rates and reduce benefits to the weakest. Now, the great concern of our partners in the Eurogroup, which we take seriously, is that the Greek state may very well allow its budget execution to be derailed again and for Greece to go back to the indignity of primary deficits from primary surpluses. This is something that our government is determined not to do. And yet we recognize that there is a problem of trust within the Eurogroup. In order to overcome it, in today's meeting, we put on the table a radical proposal, a proposal that has never been discussed before. It was not asked of us by the institution, an innovative proposal that came from us. And it is this. In the context of our agreement that we should have our fiscal council, the independent fiscal council, something equivalent to Britain's Office for Budget Responsibility, monitor the execution of the budget. Rather than simply monitoring it and coming up with reports on the evolution of the budget, we propose that there should be an automated hard deficit break that without consultation in Parliament even will be automated, will be activated when the projections of this fiscal council show that there is a high probability that in the next few months, weeks, period, the Greek budget will go into primary deficit and activate automatically without going through the political process and across the board, horizontal if you want, reduction in outlays, whether they're wages, pensions, all sorts of outlays, horizontally, small at first, gradual, in order to ensure that the budget is not derailed. This was our gesture of goodwill to our partners to show that this government is keen not only to reform the country, not only to have debt sustainability, but also to ensure that there are the mechanisms in place that are creditable and which can guarantee to the whole of the Eurozone that the Greek state will not need to borrow money from, not a single euro, from our partners again in order to pay for its, to pay its way, wages, salaries, procurement, and so on. Also, we laid down again and laid out our proposal regarding how not only to conclude this agreement, but to move beyond in a manner that will ensure that Greece returns to the markets quickly and we are no longer dependent on official sector loans. A program of quantitative easing whose very purpose is to fight the forces of deflation and at the same time to exclude from it the country, the member state, which is most afflicted by deflation, is a paradox. Let me simply end by saying that in my concluding speech, what I said was that we are dangerously close to a state of mind that accepts an accident. And I urge my colleagues not to fall prey to this state of mind. We can forge a good agreement. Our government is standing by with ideas and with a determination to cultivate the two forms of trust necessary to end this Greek drama. The trust of our partners and institutions in our government and in our society, and the trust of our people, both in our government and in Europe's capacity to produce policies that work for Europe as a whole and which end the crisis. Thank you very much.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.